And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Matsuda.
And welcome, everybody. Yes, it is that time. It's time for apologetics. You have entered into the apologetic zone. That is Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo. I'm Gary Matsuda, and welcome all to the dojo, where we talk about explaining, defending the faith, and all things Catholic. So I'm pleased to be with you, and thank you for tuning in. Got a very interesting show for you today. It's going to be on Revelation 12, and the passage where it talks about the woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and on her head is a crown of 12 stars, and she gives birth to the male child who will rule with an iron rod. Who is the woman? If you open up commentaries, typically you'll find out that the commentators believe it's Mary, or it's not Mary, that it's daughter Zion, or perhaps the Old Testament church, and actually even some Catholic commentaries will say it's not Mary. Okay, well, I'm going to tackle that because early on in apologetics, I kind of went with the commentators and figured, okay, well, that woman probably is daughter Zion, you know, probably is the Old Testament church, and it may have application for Mary, because after all, that's a Revelation 12 is an important verse. It shows the fact that Mary was assumed bodily into heaven, and but the more I researched it. In fact, the more I research for my book, Making Sense of Mary, I come to the conviction that the woman of Revelation 12 isn't just Mary in the secondary sense, but I now believe that it's Mary in the exclusive sense, in the sense that it can't be anybody but the Blessed Virgin Mary. So I want to share that with you later on in the program and kind of give you some of the things that I came up with. And I think that's pretty fascinating. So that's going to be our topic for today. And tomorrow we're going to have as a guest, by the way, Troy Guy is going to rejoin us. And the title of the program, I love the title of the program, is Nuclear Engineer Discovers the Eucharist. So Troy Guy is going to share with us how he came to grips with the Eucharist. And as always, we do our Finding the Fallacy and Meet the Early Church Father. The Finding the Fallacy for today is the appeal to flattery. And you guys are so intelligent and so witty and sharp-minded that you probably already know what that fallacy is. And also, the Meet Your Early Church Father for today is Pope St. Clement of Rome. So some interesting stuff in store for you today. And as always, you are part of the program, so please give us a call at 888-526-2151. Love to have you on. And, by the way, we're also going to go to the mailbox. The Dojo mailbox overfloweth with emails. And actually, we have two really great emails that I'm going to get to after the first break. Should be a lot of fun. So if you want, if you have any questions that you would like to ask, maybe even questions that you'd like on the air, or just situations you're in and you'd like to just kind of share, maybe you were able to explain something in a way that just it snapped for the person and really helped them. Well, you know, share the wealth. Share your information with us. We'd love to have you. Just send your emails to questions@handsonapologetics.com. That's questions@handsonapologetics.com. And, you know, I try to reply to all the emails. And sometimes, you know, sometimes they end up on the air. So that's going to be part of our segments for today. And as always, it's time for our shout-outs for those watching live stream on Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. Good to see familiar names. As I look over to the live stream section of the dojo, yes, great to see you. Nice emojis, by the way. Lots of familiar names, even Latin. No, that's Spanish. Okay, awesome. Well, hey, yeah, see, I agree. Pope St. Clement the First is awesome. And so we got a lot of stuff for you today. So without further ado, why don't we jump into our exercises for today? And the exercises our finding the fallacy. Now, this finding the fallacy is the appeal to flattery. And basically, like all these informal fallacies, they're just ways of circumventing evidence and arguments and trying to persuade somebody to your point without actually, you know, doing a valid, truthful, and, you know, straightforward argument. So the appeal to fallacy, or excuse me, the appeal to flattery is a fallacy where a person basically lavishes flattery, excessive compliments, things like that, trying to buddy up to the audience so that by kind of tapping into the audience's vanity, they'll be more prone to agree with whatever they're saying. Okay, so we see this a lot in advertising. We see this a lot in politics as well, you know. And I know that you, the audience, would not fall for that because you guys are just so smart and so intelligent. And you have really great choices in what you listen to on the radio that this will not be a problem for you. Of course, you know, I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek. I don't know. I'm not going to really explode on that fallacy because I think it's so obvious that, you know, you try to curry favor with people. And you should, your antennas should go up. You know, there are red flag issues when you're listening to somebody give a talk and perhaps they're overly trying to buddy up to the audience. For me, that's kind of when I pull back and say, okay, what's this person saying? Do I really agree with everything they say? Okay, so that's my finding the fallacy tip for today, the appeal to flattery. Now, let's jump to the Meet the Early Father. And like I said, it's Pope St. Clement of Rome. Pope St. Clement of Rome flourished roughly around AD 80. I'll try saying that three times quick. Although sometimes the dates are pushed later to 92 to 101 AD. So he's a very early church father. In fact, he's considered an apostolic father because of when he wrote. And by the way, he also is a pope, as I mentioned. Various early lists of the Bishop of Rome make Clement either the first, second, or third successor to St. Peter. There's a little bit of variety there. It's generally conceded, by the way, that Linus is the second pope. But there is some doubt as to, you know, where Clement falls on that list. Better evidence kind of places Peter, or, excuse me, places Clement as the third pope, the third successor of St. Peter, following Anacletus, who's also called Cletus, and his predecessor was Linus. So generally, Pope St. Clement of Rome is understood as the third pope in succession after Peter. You know, Cassius identifies St. Clement of Rome with a martyr, a martyred council of Titus Flavius Clement, a member of the imperial family, but that's possibly just legend. A more probable opinion is that Clement is possibly the one who is identified by St. Paul in Philippians 4:3, where he mentions Clement as a co-worker, which is kind of interesting. Now, there's no way to prove it or disprove it, but that is a possibility. Eusebius and Origen both connected, you know, that Clement with this particular early church father. And let's see, it's possible that he had personal contact with Peter. Tertullian, for example, says that Peter consecrated him as his possible successor. And boy, I don't want to get into that because there's a lot behind it. So, but he wasn't the immediate successor of St. Peter. Nevertheless, Clement may have known Peter and Peter may have instructed him. Traditional dates of his pontificate. This is important, folks, because most places, if you pick up not the Meet the Early Church Father, but if you pick up a book on patristics or patrology, you know, about early church fathers, they'll date Clement around AD 92 to 101. And lately, there's been a lot of good scholarship to suggest that actually those dates are too late, that Clement's reign was actually much more earlier than this. And the reason for that is because we have one genuine document from Pope St. Clement of Rome, which, by the way, is the sole extent authentic document we have from him, in which he gives clues that it actually is earlier. For example, there's a line in this letter where he says, owing to sudden and repeated calamities and misfortunes which have befallen us. Now, it was thought that this was a reference to persecution under Domitian. But the problem, and which would put it in 92-101, you know, that area. The problem is, however, that there's not a lot of evidence for that particular persecution. So that may not be a reference. It could be instead a reference to either the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD, or perhaps some other natural disasters that happened roughly around that time. For example, Mount Vesuvius outside of Naples in 79 AD could be what he's referencing, or some other calamities like that. So it doesn't necessarily have to be Domitian. But probably the most telling evidence, believe it or not, is that he mentions two legates to carry his letter from Rome to the church in Corinth. And he mentions them as Claudius Ephibus and Vitellius Vito. Now, these are the names of these apparently are free slaves from the Emperor Claudius, who died in 54 AD, and his wife Vitellia, who also died in 48 AD. So if you do the math, if this is in the early first century, these guys would be incredibly, incredibly old. And therefore, scholars believe that perhaps it's written a lot earlier, perhaps as early as 80 AD. And that is our Meet the Early Father for today, Pope St. Clement of Rome. Coming up on the other side of the break, we're going to go to the mailbox. You don't want to miss it. Stay tuned.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics, the Virgin Most Powerful Apologetics Dojo. And actually, before we go to the mailbox, Why don't we go to, we have a caller. The caller is Brother David. Brother David, welcome to Hands-On Apologetics.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be with you.
Well, thank you for calling.
I had a question about the appeal to flattery. I've seen it firsthand living in a monastery for 8 years in Syria, where we had a lot of friendships with refugees who are Muslims, and also I met the Prime Minister of Syria and a lot of people. And, you know, they will be willing to flatter you with a lot of gifts or with a lot of praise. We love the Virgin Mary. We respect Jesus so much. But then when they flatter you in that way, it's a really strong temptation to fail to distinguish between Muslims as human beings and a false religion that leads ultimately to destruction. And so it's hard to look at someone in the eye that flatters you and say, you know, I respect you, but I believe what you're saying is ultimately false.
Yeah, that's
true. The religion you're following, because it denies the highest truths, denies the way of salvation, and it's destruction.
Yeah, that's very well put. And of course, you know, we should also, you know, always reach out and try to build bridges. So, yeah, we do have some commonality, right? We both love the Virgin Mother, and we also honor Jesus as prophet. But the problem is, if you stop there, you fall infinitely short, right? So, I mean, it's good that you're right. You know, that is a great example of flattery, because then it kind of lowers your defenses and so on. But, you know, those are just steps to build on, because when you go deeper, as you know,
it's tragic
very
to
different.
See that temptation. Yeah. For example, Cardinal Schoenbrunn, who wrote a lot of the catechism of the Catholic Church and was picked by Cardinal Ratzinger to do so. And he said, I was the pen and every verse of the catechism passed through me. So we have someone of very high standards when it comes to Catholic teaching. And yet in his relationships with Islam, after he had met a pilgrim to Mecca, he said, I saw the light of joy in his face, and I could never speak in a disrespectful way towards his religion. Now, I found that so shocking, because when he said Islam wants to take over Europe, they see Europe as a ripe fruit for a takeover, and we shouldn't blame them. This is a quote of his. He says, because they are convinced that they are doing something good according to God's will, doing so and taking over. Yeah. I was so shocked, because this man of great intellect, he is, in a way, failed to distinguish between Muslims as people created in the image of God and, you know, and their religion. It's like you have to distinguish, because if your friend is sick and in the hospital, you love your friend, but you hate the thing that's making him sick and that's bringing him, you know, into destruction. And it says in the Bible, it's very clear, to those who reject the Son, they reject the Father. Whoever denies the Son, they deny the Father. And so it's a denial of the sonship of Christ, ultimately. It says, Jesus says very clearly in the Quran, I am not the Son of God, and to say so is blasphemy, etc. So we have these differences that are irreconcilable, unfortunately, and so it's very important, I think, to maintain a perspective of love towards them. And because we love them, we cannot fall into the fallacy of flattery and just say, yeah, everything's okay, you're okay, I'm okay, we're all going to heaven. We really need to preach to them the truth that without that saving faith in Christ Jesus and his confidence that he died for our sins and rose again, there is no way that we can enter into the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's very well said, Brother David, because, I mean, true charity isn't like, oh, they're close enough, you know, or they seem like they're
exactly
doing really well with what they have. True charity is, you know, imagine what they would have with the fullness of faith, right? It would be like somebody might be out on the streets and surviving, you know, eating street food or whatever they can find. And you might say, well, look at how well they're doing on their own. But we have a banquet, you know. It's not charitable to just say, you know, everything's well and good luck. It's we want to invite them to the banquet.
Hallelujah.
Yeah.
Whoever has son has life. Whoever does not have the son does not have life. So
yes.
We want to give them that present, that gift of Jesus that is beyond price. And we hold that not because we're great and not because we're awesome, but we hold that treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power comes from God and not from us.
Amen. Well, hey, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you. God bless you and your work. Keep it up.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Well, thank you, Brother David. That was awesome. Yeah, flattery can entice us to a kind of false charity and indifference. Like, this person thinks so highly of, what we have in common, and they seem to be doing so well. I could just let it slide. But if you really know Jesus and the fullness of the faith, you can't do that. That's not charitable. Charitable is sharing, pointing them to the banquet. Yeah, pointing to the banquet, to the fullness of Christ in the church. All right, beautiful. Awesome. Well, let's go to the Dojo mailbox. Man, that's a great call. The first one is from Claudia. And Claudia writes, "Hi, Gary. Great show on Virgin Most Powerful Radio. Thank you. Appreciate it. How do you respond to this? A fallen away Catholic cousin living overseas was horrified about my family and I, who had gone to venerate the heart of St. John Vianney last week. She went on to say, especially my husband and I, having postgraduate degrees and being intelligent people, how can we fall for such a medieval practice that desecrated a body? Then she went on about people believing on magical powers of dead bodies and so on. And she said, I was so excited to share, but was surprised at her response. And so what Claudia did was she mentioned some points that she was going to point out. And, man, I really can't add to this, but I'll add a little bit, but not much. She says the points that I thought about responding to her as follows. Number one, we only adore God. By venerating a saint, we show our respect and recognition of his or her virtues. Awesome. Number two, there's no superstition or magic. Healing comes from God through whom he chooses, such as Virgin Mary, saints, etc. Excellent. Point number three, we ask for their prayers and intercession of God according to his will in our request, since they are already in the beatific vision. Basically, it would be answered because they're in heaven. Yeah, absolutely. I love number four. Listen to this, folks. She writes, it's not a medieval practice. It goes back to the catechisms. I love that. Yes, it's not this newfangled medieval stuff. It goes way, way back. She writes, the bodies of the saints and martyrs were given a place under the altar. Yeah, absolutely. It goes all the way back to the beginning. And five incorruptible bodies of the saints only occur in the Catholic Church. There's no scientific explanation. The power of God has shown this to us. She says, thank you much, and God bless to you and your family. Thank you, Claudia, for that awesome letter. I wanted to share it with everybody because, man, those are great bullet points, each and every one. I mean, the only thing I could possibly add is 2 Kings 13. There is an interesting thing that goes on where some people were burying a dead man, and some bands of Moabites come by, and they were caught. They had the body. They couldn't run away. So they tossed the body into the tomb of Elisha the prophet. And once the dead man came into contact with Elisha's bones, he came to life. So, that kind of shows, that God can work miracles to manifest his power and grace in the person's life. In this case, the prophet Elisha. And also in Acts 19, you have people touching the apostles with face cloths and aprons. And applying those items to the sick, and the disease left them and evil spirits came out. Basically, it's relics, right? So, yeah, it goes all the way back. Even, there's kind of a little bit even in the Old Testament. And the idea behind it, of venerating relics and so on, is that we're so united to Christ as his body that Christ works miracles even through us, even if we're not alive, And Claudia, let me recommend this book. This is a really interesting book. It's written by Peter Brown. The title is The Cult of the Saints its rise and function in Latin Christianity. So that what he points out is something really interesting, because people think that venerating relics is a pagan practice that somehow Catholics kind of mixed up with the Christian faith. Well, what he points out is that, no, it's the Christian understanding about the bodies of the holy ones that is radically different than the pagans. See, the pagans, they were scared of death. They didn't want dead bodies anywhere near them. In fact, they wouldn't bury the dead in the cities. They would bury them outside the city so that they wouldn't have any contact with them. Well, when God becomes man and becomes one of us, and we're united to him through baptism, that whole worldview changed. And now, the bodies of the holy ones who have passed have become venerable, right? So Christians moved the bodies of the dead into the centers of the city. Like you mentioned in your email, the bodies were underneath the altars. And also this practice of relics and things like that. All of that sprang from a uniquely Christian culture. In fact, I believe Peter Brown, I could be mistaken, but I believe he points out in his book that if you want to find an area that was touched by Christianity, look for where the dead are. Like if it's inside the middle of the city, that's Christianity. So it isn't some sort of pagan holdover that we got and kind of mixed in with our own faith. Rather, it's authentic Christianity. Why? Because when we're resurrected, we'll be resurrected in the body, the very same flesh we're in. And so, so awesome email. Thank you for sending it to us. Let's see. I have 2 minutes. I could probably just read this email and we'll answer it on the other side of the break. It's from my buddy Alex R. Wrote the second letter. He says, "Hello, Gary Machuda. I want to start off by telling you I love your show and help me grow and inform my faith. The guests you have on the show, their testimonies have made a great impact in my faith life, and I feel proud to be Catholic and belong to the true Catholic Church of Jesus." Awesome. Thank you, Alex. You made my millennium. All right, a question that I had for you is, why and where in the Bible do Jehovah Witnesses believe that their eternal reward is on earth? And how can I refute that belief from the Bible that our hope is and should be in heaven with God eternally? Thank you very much in advance, and God bless you. So that's from Alex. Awesome questions about Jehovah Witnesses, Alex. Why do they believe in paradise earth? And how should we show that that's incorrect? Well, you'll find out on the other side of the break, folks. Listen to Hands-On Apologetics. Stay tuned.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, "I want my husband to be on fire for the faith." Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference, or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith, because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. you can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Yes, we are in the dojo mailbox going through emails, and had a great email from Claudia. And right before the break, I read the email from Alex. Alex basically asked, where did Jehovah's Witnesses get this idea that in the Bible that eternal reward is here on earth? And how do we refute it? Thanks, Alex. Thank you for your kind words. We appreciate it. Let's see. Well, okay, folks, this is going to get a little unusual, okay? And whenever we talk about what's called pseudo-Christian groups, it does get a little unusual. Jehovah's Witnesses have two destinies that believers go, or the righteous go. One is that there will be 144,000 who will rule with Christ in heaven. This is people who are known as those who have heavenly hope. And they get that from Revelation 14, 1 through 4. Now, not only that, now those are the only ones who will be in heaven. Okay. It's the 144,000. They think most of them filled, but there could be some open spots, you know, that they've gone back and forth over the years. And in addition to this heavenly class, they also bring in John 3:3, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. So the only people who have the heavenly hope, the 144,000, are those who are born again. So those who are destined for paradise earth, they're not born again. They're also called anointed Christians and so on and so forth. So, and oh, by the way, also the 144,000 are the only ones who could partake of their version of the Lord's Supper, which they call the memorial or emblem. So if you ever go to like a Passover meal that they have at a Watchtower, or not Watchtower, Kingdom Hall, you'll find out that practically no one takes communion, because only the 144,000 could be there, and practically no one is alive today that belongs to that class. So what about the rest, or the vast majority of Jehovah's Witnesses? Well, they believe that there is another class of people that they call the other sheep. That's in John 10:16. It's also called the great crowd in Revelation 7:9. Revelation 7:9 says, "After this, I had a vision of a great multitude, which no one could count, from every nation, race, people, and tongue. And they stood before the throne and before the Lamb, wearing white robes and holding palm branches in their hands." Now, the Watchtower up to 1935 believed they only believed in the heavenly hope. It wasn't until afterwards that they came up with this paradise earth, and they believed that the great crowd mentioned there, the vast multitude that's standing before the throne and the Lamb, are those on earth. That's paradise earth. And how they figure that out is they bring in yet another text, Matthew 25, the great throne judgment, where all the nations are gathered before the throne of Christ. And they say, see, this is taking place on earth, because they're standing on earth before the throne. So since the great crowd stands on earth before the throne in Matthew 25, they believe that in Revelation 7:9, the great crowd mentioned there is actually on earth, hence paradise earth. Okay, so how do we respond to it? Well, you know, pray for them, number one. And also do a little digging on your own. You know, you need to get a hold of the text and understand the text, Alex, before you start interacting with them, because they're very good. They know how to change directions, change the conversation. But what you want to focus is, where is the great cloud located? Okay, so the first text, Alex, you want to go to is Revelation 19, verse 1. says, after these things, I heard what was a loud voice of the great crowd. Okay, so Revelation 19, John hears the voice of a great crowd in heaven. Okay, so where's the great crowd? It's not on Paradise Earth, it's in heaven. Also, you could go to Revelation 9 and 10. And basically, you know, you could just work through this. He says they were singing a new song saying, quote, "You are worthy to take the scroll and open its seals because you were slaughtered. And with your own blood, you brought persons for God out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation. And you made them a kingdom and priests to your God. That notice that they will rule as kings over the earth." Okay, so in a sense, there's every tribe, tongue, nation, but they're ruling over the earth. Where? It's part of a priestly kingdom before God. Revelation 7:11 says, "All the angels are standing around the throne and the elders and the four living creatures. And they all fell upon their faces before the throne and worship God." So where's the throne of God? It's in heaven, where all the angels and the elders and living creatures are. It's not on earth. Okay. So, you know, that's a great counterverse to their Matthew 25 verse. And again, you know, you have Revelation 5:8, where he took a scroll and the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each of them having a harp and gold bowls full of incense, and the incense were the prayers of the Holy One. Again, the throne of the Lamb is where? It's not on Paradise Earth. It's in heaven. So I think the best single verse that you could bring up, Alex, would be Revelation 19:1. They heard a voice, loud voice, a great crowd in heaven. And explain to them, how can they be on earth if they're in heaven? Simple as that. Okay. And that's it for the Dojo Mailbox for today. Great letters, by the way. And if you have any questions and you like to throw out, or maybe, you know, like Claudia, a situation came up that you just wanted to share, and she made some awesome points in that letter, shoot us an email at questions@handsonapologetics.com. Love to hear from you, folks. Love to hear from you. All right, so let's talk about Revelation 12, shall we? Revelation 12, man, I completely spun around on this in my interpretation of it. So first, I guess we should begin by reading at least a few verses from Revelation 12, just in case you're not familiar with it. Okay, at the end of Revelation 11, John sees the Ark of the Covenant in heaven, right? And then Revelation 12:1 begins and it says, "A great sign appeared in the sky, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was with child and wailed aloud in pain as she labored to give birth." And then a dragon appears, and the dragon stood before the woman in verse 4, about to give birth to devour her child when she gave birth. She gave birth to a son, a male child, destined to rule all the nations into iron rod. And her child was caught up to God and his throne. Then the woman flees into the desert. Okay, so this verse is important in apologetics because it's a great verse to show that Mary's assumed bodily into heaven, right? There is a sign that appeared in heaven, the woman. And notice the woman isn't a disembodied soul like you see earlier in the book of Revelation, but she has a body. She's clothed with the sun. The moon's under her feet, right? So she has a body, she has feet. And on her head's 12 crown of 12 stars. So she has a head. So she's seen bodily in heaven. Now, people will say, no, you're misunderstanding this. The woman is not the Blessed Virgin Mary, but the woman is really just a symbol or a sign of the Old Testament church, or maybe the New Testament church, or Daughter Zion, this personification of righteous Israel. But it's not Mary. In fact, I've even seen some Catholic commentators who actually explicitly say, this is not Mary. Well, when I started doing research, folks, what I realized is that the more you look into the background of this text, the more you come to realize that really couldn't be anybody but Mary. Okay. So I have several arguments, several layers. So let's try to go through a couple of them before our next break. The first one is, the imagery here is taken from Genesis 3:15, the first gospel. Because we have basically a set of characters that are identical. You have the dragon, who is the ancient serpent. Okay, so you have the serpent, like with Adam and Eve. You have a woman, right? That's the name of Adam's wife. And you have her seed. Okay, so you have three figures. And you also have enmity between these figures, as you'll see, not only with the dragon trying to devour the male child, but also later on you'll see that the dragon makes war with the woman. And that fits perfectly with the first prophecy about Jesus in the Bible, Genesis 3:15. It says, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He will bruise your head while you bruise him on the heel. Okay, so God says to the devil that he's going to put this enmity between himself and the woman, between her seed and his seed. And ultimately, her seed's going to crush the head of the devil. Okay, so who is the seed of the woman who crushes the head of the devil? Well, for a Christian, the answer is obvious. It's Jesus, right? Jesus is the one who destroys the works of the devil. So, and he's bruised, by the way, on the cross. Okay, so that's part of the prophecy. And also notice that the devil's at enmity with Jesus. Why? Because he's sinless. Now, so we got the serpent, that's the devil. We know the woman's seed is Jesus. Who's the woman? Is it the Old Testament church, New Testament church, daughter Zion, or Mary? Well, it can't be the New Testament church, because the New Testament church couldn't give birth to Christ. It was Christ who, in a sense, created the New Testament church, right? Where you were part of his body. So then you can cross off from your list that this is the New Testament church, the woman. That doesn't make sense. In fact, later on, the woman in Revelation 12 has offspring, and the devil makes war with the rest of her offspring, those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony. Very good. Yeah, I just noticed in the chat room, David, excellent. You beat me to it. So that's the church, right? So, who's the woman? Well, could it be the Old Testament church? Well, was the Old Testament church at enmity with the devil? Sometimes. Sometimes not. Same thing's true with daughter Zion. Daughter Zion sometimes is righteous, you know, and sometimes daughter Zion's kind of wicked and gets punished. So, the most obvious answer, I believe, that who's the mother of the Messiah? If Jesus is the Messiah, the answer is Mary. Okay. Now, does that prove it's exclusively Mary? No. But when we come back on the other side of the break, I'm going to show you some other lines of argument that shows that this woman can't be anybody else but Mary. So stay tuned, everybody.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. We're asking the question, who's the woman of Revelation 12? And my answer is Mary. I'm going through different reasons why I believe so. And, you know, just FYI, if you are really interested in this topic, I cover it in my book, Making Sense of Mary. Let's see if I can get that on the screen. There you go. It'll give you all the quotes, all the verses, everything you need to know. Okay, next. A great sign appeared in heaven, and the sign is a woman who's about to give birth. Now, the Old Testament evidence for this is interesting, because that same phrase, by the way, in Revelation 12:2, is also found in Matthew 1:18. Now, when the birth of Christ was as follows: when his mother Mary was betrothed to Joseph, before they came together, she was found with child. So it's the same "with child" phrase in both places. And he goes on to say that this is to fulfill the scripture: behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and his name was Emmanuel, which means God with us, right? Now, what you may not know is that there's lots of prophetic threads in the Old Testament about this deliverance of God that's going to happen with the Messiah. We, for example, in Isaiah 7:14, what we just said, you know, the virgin will conceive and bear a son, and his name will be Emmanuel, and that is when deliverance happens. But there's other trigger signs. The sign that God is about to gather together all 12 tribes of Israel, okay? And this happens with the Messiah. And what's the sign? What's the trigger sign of this prophecy is going to be fulfilled? You guessed it. It's a woman with child. Okay. For example, in Micah 2, verses 2, some Bibles have 3. It says, when she who is in labor has borne a child. Okay, so the trigger sign is that when she who is to give birth has born. That is the trigger sign where the 12 tribes of Israel are going to begin to be restored. Okay. And there's lots of other trigger signs too. And they're all the same. It's always a woman will give birth, right? So the question is, well, Matthew tells us that that sign is fulfilled in Mary. Okay. And, you know, that fits perfectly with Micah and some of the other passages where this woman brings forth a son. Okay, so it's part of the trigger signs of the Old Testament. And that also kind of points to Mary, the literal mother of the Messiah. Okay, now here's the cool part, folks. This is the one that I really flipped me from thinking, okay, Mary in a secondary sense to, no, this has to be only Mary. We talked about this in the previous broadcast. The kingdom of David, there was an institution where the son of David, the king, would sit on his throne, and ruling next to him is the queen mother. Okay, his mother was the queen. Why? Because kings had many different queens. You know, they had harems, so you couldn't have all the queens sitting up there. So instead, what they would do is that the king would promise one of his wives that her son will sit on his throne, and then when the king dies or he's getting old and there's a son that's old enough to take the throne, what would happen is the son would become king and his mother would become the queen mother, and she'd actually have a throne at his right hand. And it was a very important institution in Israel, or I should say in Judea. Israel didn't really follow that practice. But with the sons of David, they followed this practice. Now, what's so incredible about this is that she was kind of a guarantee, a visible sign of the king's right to sit on the throne. Okay? So that way, if you dishonor the queen mother, you're really dishonoring the king, right? Because if you dishonor the queen mother, you're kind of like casting mud upon, you know, his birthright to sit on the throne. Because why is he on the throne? It's because his mother received the promise from the king. Okay? And interesting enough, in the Davidic monarchy, only three kinds of people wore crowns. The king, the queen mother, and the queens. Okay? So, let's go back to Revelation 12, so shall we, and kind of plug this in. Okay, the woman's clothed with the sun, the moon at her feet. She gives birth to the male child who will rule with an iron rod. That comes from the Psalms. I think it's Psalm 2. It's the Messiah. Okay? Now, she has a crown of 12 stars on her head. Who is she? Well, she can't be the king because she just gave birth to her son, the king. Okay? So cross that off. She can't be one of the queens, right? Because the queens are married to the king. But since she gave birth to the male child who will rule with an iron rod, she is the queen mother. So whoever the woman is, she is a queen mother figure. And, of course, she's crowned with 12 stars. Okay? Now, here's where things get interesting, folks. If someone were to say, let's say you had a guy who tried to pretend to be king, and he had his mother on the throne. Or actually, he doesn't even have his mother. And someone says, what right do you have to sit on the throne? He couldn't say, well, you know, my mother, my queen mother was all of Israel. Okay? Or my queen mother is all the elect. Or my queen mother was all the righteous, and through them I became king. Right? The guy would be booted out of the throne. Right? He's not part of the succession of the line of David. Why? Because that only comes through the literal queen mother. Okay? That's why we said that she's a visible, tangible sign of the son's right to the throne. Now, what does this mean about the woman in Revelation 12? Well, she has to be a literal, physical mother of Jesus. Okay? Saying it's all of Israel or some symbol doesn't work. Why? For the same reason it wouldn't work if someone pretended to be on the throne, right? It's not a symbolic succession. It has to be a literal succession. I mean, after all, she's the guarantee that he belongs on the throne. So if it's literal, and it has to be a literal, real, historic person, who could it be? It has to be the Blessed Virgin Mary. It can't be a sign or a symbol. I mean, think of it. Let's say the woman in Revelation 12, let's just say that's the Old Testament church. Well, anybody could sit on the throne and say, my mother is the Old Testament church. Why? Because they're all Jews, right? It wouldn't make any sense. So it has to be Mary, okay? Let's see. There's so much more we could go through. Now, one of the reasons why even Catholic exegetes have problems with identifying Mary is because they claim it's daughter Zion is a collective symbol. And the reason for that is they say, well, it can't be Mary because in Revelation, the woman is travailing in pain. She shouts out in pain as she gives birth to her son. And they say, see, it's a Catholic belief. It's not really a dogma, but it's a Catholic belief that when Mary gave birth to Jesus, she gave birth without birth pangs. Okay. And so if Mary's, you know, and birth pangs, by the way, were part of the curse for women in Genesis 3 as a result of the original sin. So if Mary is giving a painful birth, right, then that would imply maybe has sin. And it also go against this belief in the church that Mary gave birth to Jesus without pain. Okay. So therefore, these exegetes say, well, it must be daughter Zion. Okay. Now, here's something really interesting. I hope I can do it in the few minutes I have. I hope I can do it. It's proper. Give it its proper due. Why do we believe that Mary gave birth to Jesus without birth pains? It comes from a prophecy in Isaiah 66, verse 7. It says, before she travailed, she brought forth. Before her pain came, she gave birth to a boy. Okay? And so the early church fathers appealed to Isaiah 66 with their belief that when Jesus was born for Mary, that Mary didn't suffer birth pains. Okay? Fine. So, and these exegetes will say, see, that can't be Mary. Well, here's the problem, folks. It can't be daughter Zion either. Why? Because Isaiah 66 is talking about daughter Zion. So, you know, if you're going to say, no, this can't be Mary, guess what? It can't be daughter Zion either. So we have to look at this and say, okay, well, what exactly is going on here? Now, the problem is that they understand Revelation 12 with the woman giving birth to the son as referring to Jesus' birth in Bethlehem. But if you look at the passage, there's really no reason to believe that. It says that she gives birth, but notice that there's nothing about his public ministry, nothing about the cross, nothing about the resurrection. All it goes is it skips from his birth to the ascension. Okay? And it talks about this dragon that's ready to devour him. That doesn't sound like Bethlehem. But then what they forget is that Mary becomes a mother twice in her life. First time in Bethlehem when she gives birth to Jesus. But she becomes a mother again at the foot of the cross, where Jesus gives John into her care. So Mary actually is a mother twice. Why? Because by giving birth to Jesus, the head, she is also the mother of Jesus, the body, the church. And I believe Revelation 12 is talking not about Bethlehem, but about the cross. Okay? And that's why Mary, or the woman, is travailing in pain. That's the fulfillment of Simeon's prophecy that a sword will also pierce her soul. In other words, the pains that Mary did not receive in Bethlehem, she received spiritual pains at the foot of the cross. That's that second birth, the birth of the church. And so this whole idea that because the woman's in pain, she can't be Mary, I think it can't be anybody but Mary. Okay, so hopefully I did it justice. I only did it in a few minutes. So like I said, if you want more information, pick up my book, Making Sense of Mary. I have all the stuff right there. Man, this hour just flew, and it was a lot of fun too. I hope you had fun as well. As I said, coming up tomorrow, Troy Guy is going to come back, and a nuclear engineer is going to explain how he discovered the Eucharist. So I can't wait to hear how he came to believe in Jesus' real presence in the Eucharist. And coming up next, the dynamic duo of Catholic Talk Radio, the Terry and Jesse Show. Two guys I admire and esteem highly. And man, get ready for a high impact discussion. And as always, it's time to turn off the dojo lights here and shut down the Midwest Command Center. I hope you guys had fun. Thank you so much for listening to the program, tuning in. I appreciate it. Can't tell you how much I appreciate it. And you know, everybody have a great and blessed Fat Tuesday. I'll be seeing you tomorrow on Ash Wednesday. Take care. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.